You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
This week on Unforgotten.
I'm Mitch McRae. I'm with the Mobile County Sheriff's Office.
Stephen Pearson was coming up on his 53rd birthday on December 23rd, 2000.
Just being helpful, offered to sign for the package and drop it off himself.
Well, in between that time, Stephen's trailer was broken into.
Grimes told Birch that Stephen seemed scared, visibly shaken. And during that visit, he started talking about leaving town.
Her father had always referenced a close friend and that if he ever needed to disappear, that would help him do that.
Stephen mentioned that he likes to go to the casinos in Mississippi. The possibility exists that Stephen drove his Impala there.
Someone found his Impala, and when the deputies arrived, they didn't see a missing person. They saw a cover-up.
Hey everyone, this is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten,
where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
And now for Season 2, Episode 5, Stephen Pearson.
Hey, guys, and welcome back. So, last week, and I guess beginning of this week, there was some big news coming out of Mobile. You know, we had the trial for, I'm not sure if it's Demetric or Dimitric Hooper.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I always say Demetric.
I say Demetric.
Yeah, because I wasn't sure if it was actually, I was spelling it wrong for a long time, because I was thinking it was Dimitri, and then I realized it wasn't. Yeah, so I don't know. Yeah.
He's the father of Brittany Robinson,
right?
Who was 14 years old when she went missing in June of 2012. And, you know, back then, whenever she went missing, they ended up arresting him for custodial interference. He comes in, he gets sentenced for custodial interference, and then, because he goes on the run, right? And they find him in Arkansas at this psychiatric type facility, and the U.S. Marshals bring him in. He ends up getting convicted of custodial interference. He was sentenced to 10 years, only served, I think, 2. They've never found her. All these years go by, and now we're, what, 13 years in, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But they go announce last year that they're arresting him for intentional murder charges for Brittany.
Yeah, which was a huge surprise at first.
Yeah, because they've never found her. And they're not, that I've seen anyway, there hasn't been any kind of updates to say, hey, we've got this new evidence, information, anything to lead us to believe that now these charges are more appropriate than they were back then, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for whatever reason, they decide to arrest him last year on those charges. And he just actually went through trial last week. And it absolutely breaks my heart for Brittany's mother, Tiana, because she had to relive all of that.
I just can't even imagine.
God, I cannot imagine it. WKRG, I think it was WKRG that had a reporter in the courtroom every day. And one of their daily reports that they had posted was talking about, I think it was opening statements. And the DA or assistant DA that was prosecuting the case, they made a comment that at the point that this case was going to trial, it was now almost as long as Brittany had been alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, that really...
That whew, makes it
talking about
in,
a reality smack,
yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that Tiana got really upset.
Yeah.
And I was messaging Tiana throughout the week, just saying, hey, checking in on you. You know, let me know if you need anything. And I can't imagine, really, having to listen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's, you live with that every day from that point forward, knowing this
yeah.
is how things are and still having all these unanswered questions. And then you think, okay, we're here. We are finally going to get some answers. We are finally going to get some kind of resolution. But then on Monday, the jury comes back with a verdict of not guilty.
Yeah.
And that is devastating.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we've talked about this and we've seen it in other cases. You know, no body homicides are really, really hard. They happen. You know, I mean, they people do get convicted and more yeah. than they used to, but they are still very hard to win a case like that. So you really, really want, you know, the DA and the state, you know, they should have a really rock solid case before going into trial. And I'm a little
right.
disappointed if they didn't. I don't really, you know, not being there, I don't know personally they didn't, but... obviously, they didn't win the case. So
that's one of the things. And when we talk to these agencies, they say, you know, we only have one shot at this. We mm-hmm. want to make it the strongest that we have.
Yep.
And I know that on one of those days that the reporter that was in there reported, I've never been so infuriated in my life.
Yeah.
That there were... four bones, or I think it was four, found around Hooper's home when they did one of the searches.
Yeah.
Then I think that was about it. I really hate that I wasn't able to go over there during the day because I'm really close to the courthouse.
Yeah.
My work was crazy. But the defense counsel follows up with that and says, yeah, but you never confirmed that those four bones were human.
Yeah.
How do you go to a no-body homicide trial and not know whether or not the bones that you have are human?
Yeah. I mean, to me, that is, you know, you and I talked about this offline. Just the one search party that I was able to be a part of so far, back here in Washington, one of the very first things they do when you go out on a search party is they have, or at least the one I was attending, is they have a whole thing telling the volunteers, you know, what to expect, what they're going to do, where the map is. And they had the county coroner come in and talk to us. She had examples of bones sitting out and what to look for. And then yeah. she said, you know, you're going to come across probably a lot of bones out here because it's very woody. You're probably going to see lots of, like, you know, dead animal bones and people hunting when they shouldn't be hunting, leaving their, you know, things out here. And the very first thing that we came across, and it's probably the only thing I can share about this, but was a pile of bones. And the coroner came over right away and looked at it and said, you know, we have to confirm it, but these are definitely, you know, animal bones. And how, so I just can't even, how can they get them and not have somebody look at them and determine that? I just can't even, it just floors me that they couldn't, that they hadn't done it. It should be like the very first thing they do.
I'm hoping that maybe the DA's office came back and said, oh yeah, we did. And that just wasn't reported.
It could be, yeah.
I mean, that is my hope, but I feel like that would have been reported.
I do.
Had they done that.
I wonder if we can get trial transcripts after a certain period of time. I know they have to like do things, but I would love to see that.
The order that came out was very detailed. It talked about what they did each day. And actually, I've never seen an order come out like this after trial. And maybe it's just because we don't typically do criminal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really interesting to read it. And we'll post that up. If you're looking for a way to show up and give back, it's time to lace up those sneakers. Registration is open for Vocal's Voices of Victims 5K happening on June 21st, 2025. We've posted the link on our social media pages, and you'll also find it in the episode description.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own. Surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So, we've been kind of working our way up to this episode. Right. We have been fortunate enough over the last, well, it's last couple of years, really, to work with several agencies on different cases. But the first one that we were going to do a podcast on is the case that we've been working on with the Mobile County Sheriff's Office. And you guys may have seen that in the news recently because we put a billboard up in Grand Bay.
Right.
Thank you to the Mobile County Commission for that. I think we said that in almost every podcast because we are so appreciative.
We were. It's been great. It looks really great. So
I mean, and it also helps that our favorite investigator Mitch is over at the Mobile County Sheriff's Office. So you know.
Hey Mitch.
Hey Mitch. And you guys are gonna get to hear from him. I texted him today actually and said, hey, guess what? They're gonna hear from you, Hollywood.
So we decided, since we just spoke with Hollywood, that there's no better time than the present to bring Mitch right on in. Why don't you introduce yourself, Mitch?
Okay. I'm Mitch McRae. I'm with the Mobile County Sheriff's Office. I've been employed by the Sheriff's Office for a total of about 42 years. I spent most of my career as a major crimes detective and supervisor over the major crimes unit. I worked, I think, 18 years strictly working nothing but homicides. And then I actually retired, went to work for the U.S. Marshals for a couple of years, or actually for 8 years, and then left them and now are back under the employment of the Mobile County Sheriff's Department. And I'm focused on working cold case homicides and also do some internal affairs investigations.
Nice. You're not tired, are you?
So, Stormy, have you ever done a favor for someone that just didn't really sit right afterwards?
Oh, hell yeah. Probably several things, honestly. Because I tend to be very, you know, I hate to stereotype as women, but I tend to be a nurturer and I tend to like overcommit myself because I feel like I have to help everybody. I guess that can be a good thing and that can be a really bad thing.
You do. Women do most of the time.
I know. It's that mothering instinct.
Even when they know, like they got the gut feeling like this isn't the way that I should go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they still be like, but I already committed.
Yep. Yep. And then you like, you don't feel like you can let that person down or you can like, well, I said I would, now I have to type, you know, you just can't give it up. Or you feel like you don't want them to think that you couldn't do it.
Yeah. Or people in general are like, huh, mama didn't raise no quitter.
Yeah.
So hard as that I'd do it. That, and here I am. Even if I know that this isn't right, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah. Well, I have to tell you, I had a neighbor. Well, I'm going to back up here. In my previous neighborhood, before we moved here, when we got there, we had these neighbors introduce themselves, you know, who they were. And they're, one of the neighbors is an elderly person. And we got to meet her, and she was really nice. And the other neighbors, they said that they all kind of had an understanding, I guess you would say. They all looked in on her. And so, you know, like if something came up or they hadn't seen her come out of the house in a while or, you know, she was sick, they'd help her out type of thing. But one of the neighbors that was really the one that kind of led the charge, I guess, was moving. When she introduced herself to me, she was telling me about this and she goes, we would really love it if you could, you know, join in and, you know, help out once in a while. Does that, do you feel like you could do that? And like, I'm looking at her and I'm like thinking, I totally should do that because she's a new neighbor and I'm a new neighbor. And what, you know, how could I say no to that?
And it's a whole neighborhood. So everybody's sharing here.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, sure. Why can't I do this? I'm like, oh, yeah, that would be really nice to be able to do. I'm sure we can, you know, pop in once in a while. And I'm telling you, she's a very lovely woman. But saying yes to that and going over and visiting her even just once put me on a list of activities that I would, one I either can't do or don't want to do, like quilting, because...
Oh my God, I can't quilt
anything. I think people that quilt are fantastically talented and I love that they can do it, but it's not my cup of tea. And honestly, I can't sew to save my life.
I can't even sew a button.
So quilting, no.
And do you know how to quilt now?
Oh, no.
Like a volunteer for this?
Oh. No. I kind of felt just going into it that I knew right away I shouldn't have committed the way I did. I jumped in with both feet when I was talking to her, more or less, and I should have known better. So, yes,
it's not because you don't care about...
No, it's not at all.
...elderly neighbors.
No, not at all.
You have an elderly mother.
I do.
So I don't want anybody yelling at us about it.
Yeah. I mean... You know, at the time, we were not close to where my mother was. And so that was harder for me to get there. But, you know, if I can't stay in touch with my family adequately, it's really difficult for me to think I can help a neighbor with ongoing, you know, difficulties. So there were enough people in the neighborhood that committed to it. So, but yes, I mean, totally understand what you mean. There's always those things that you feel like, oh, I really should, you know, do this. And then you think after the fact, was that really a smart choice?
Yeah.
How about you? That was a loaded question. I can hear it in your voice.
Yeah. I let someone leave a toothbrush one time and they moved in. Won't make that mistake again. So, unfortunately, Smavers.
That's a new word. Smavers.
I know. It's kind of like s'mores.
I kind of like that. What was the other one? We're gonna Unabama it.
Unabama it.
Yeah. You said it in a while. I'm going to remember that. I'm going to put a little note down there.
Unfortunately, those small favors are how this story starts. So there was a local postal worker who was struggling to find an address in a quiet Mobile County neighborhood. And Stephen Pearson, just being helpful, offered to sign for the package and drop it off himself. Only there was a slight difference in the address the package was meant for and the one Stephen delivered it to. And that package wasn't just mail. It was roughly 10 pounds of marijuana.
What are the odds? I guess, maybe. Maybe they're better than I think they are. But
and this is back in 2000.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You think it's probably not as likely.
Mm-hmm. So Stephen later stopped by to make sure the neighbors had received the package. And they told him what was inside. And Stephen did what most people wouldn't. He just told them if they didn't report it, he would. And then he vanished. No dramatic exit, no packed bags, no answers, just an abandoned car in the woods a month later, staged according to Mobile County Sheriff's Paul Birch.
But here's the twist. In the days leading up to his disappearance, Stephen had told friends and coworkers that he was leaving town, and no one would ever find him. So what really happened that December? Did Stephen Pearson vanish by choice? Or did someone make that decision for him?
So before gas station receipts, before the phone calls and the cash withdrawals, before anyone knew to worry, there was Stephen. To understand how strange this story really is, you have to understand him.
I located Cooter and talked to him quite a bit, and he described Stephen as his very best friend. He was actually the best man at his wedding. They had been friends for many years, and he just thought the world of Stephen. He said he was a really super guy, said he was very funny, liked to tell stories, and he said he was about halfway full of crap. He said you could never believe the entire story because he embellished the stories. And he was everybody knew that about Stephen, that he just liked to talk and embellish things. And throughout their years of sitting around drinking beer and talking and telling stories, and they were neighbors, so you know, he knew quite a bit about Stephen. Cooter had been served in the military during Vietnam and was actually in Vietnam. And there's been indication that Stephen had told people that he had been in the military. But when I questioned Cooter about it, he said, me and Stephen used to talk about Nam all the time, but he never told me that he was in the military. So, he never brought it up. And and we've been able to not confirm that Stephen was ever in the military. But Cooter really misses him. Hopes we can find him. Wants to be very helpful about it. But he really couldn't add much to it other than the last time he saw them, he said it was like one or two days before Christmas. He was working on his house. He was hanging sheetrock, and Stephen drives up, and he had the window open, so he saw Stephen drive up, and he was driving the red Blazer. He started walking up to the house, and he yelled at him through the windows and said, "Come on in." He goes, "No, I'm just stopping by to drop off a Christmas present. I've got other presents to deliver. I've got other things to do." So he walked up to the window, and he handed him this Christmas present, which was a six-pack of Michelob beer.
I think that's funny.
Yeah. And he stood at the window and talked to Cooter and his wife, Erlene. through the window and wish them a Merry Christmas and just small talk for a few minutes. And then he went to leave, said, I've got to go deliver more presents. And as he actually turned to walk away and stopped and came back to the window and said, hey, this is goodbye. I'll never see y'all again. I'm going to disappear and you'll never find me. And they looked at each other and kind of like, what are you talking about? He said, I've got to go. I've made plans. I'm going to disappear and you won't find me. You will never see me again. And he walked off. Cougar said he looked at his wife and they kind of like, okay, that's one of Steven's jokes he's playing, or,
yeah,
you know, didn't take him as serious.
Right.
And they saw Steven get in his red blazer and drive off. And that's the last time they ever saw him. And Cooter said about 2 days later, which would have been the 27th, he said 2 or 3 days later, which would have been the 27th of December, he saw deputies up at Steven's house, and he walked up there to see what was going on, and that's when he found out that Steven was missing.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Julie, his daughter, called him her best friend. He would treat me like a princess, she said. As I got older, he was still my daddy, but he was my friend. Stephen was the kind of man who brought bread and candy to neighbors on Christmas morning. A man who wasn't flashy, but always showed up when people needed him. That kind of man doesn't just vanish into thin air. And yet, he did. Julie still hangs his stocking every year. Every year, when it should be joyous, she says, there's the empty stocking still hanging, and until I have an answer, I'll keep looking. Until the day I die.
And she's not the only one. Sheriff Paul Birch has been chasing the truth about Stephen Pearson for over 2 decades. He was just a young investigator when the case first landed on his desk. Now, he's the man responsible for keeping all of Mobile County safe. But through all the years, all the cases, this is the one that he never let go. It's the only unsolved case that he still carries.
It's one of those we feel pretty certain, you know, who the parties are that are responsible, but, you know, his body's never been recovered. And, you know, it's just a, you know, one of those cases that you never forget about because, you know, we don't have justice for the family or the victim.
And he has never been shy about what he believes. Birch is convinced Stephen was murdered, and he believes he knows exactly who's behind it. He said it more than once. Someone like that doesn't disappear when there is no reason. And yet somehow, Stephen did. And let's be clear, Stephen didn't vanish into thin air.
Well, nobody ever does.
Exactly. Not because that's obviously impossible, but because in the days leading up to his disappearance, something was building. There were phone calls, bank withdrawals, conversations that, looking back, sound less like casual chatter and more like goodbyes. Or maybe warnings. So let's go back to the beginning.
Stephen Pearson was coming up on his 53rd birthday on December 23rd, 2000. He was living in a mobile home located on Kingbird Road in Grand Bay and working as an engineer at Ingalls Shipbuilding. He took 2 weeks off for the holidays starting on December 15th, but instead of relaxing, Stephen stayed busy. Co-workers said he stopped by the office on his vacation just to check in, chat. His supervisor, Lynn Massengale, recalled Stephen mentioning on several occasions he was having trouble with a relative and he needed to, quote, get away.
Now, here's where things start to feel off. Between December 1st and December 25th, Christmas Eve, Stephen took out several cash advances and made a string of ATM withdrawals. On December 1st, he pulled out $2,500 from a line of credit. And then on December 20th, he paid nearly all of it back.
That's odd.
I know. And this is just December. I mean, if we go back to like November, he was making all kind of ATM withdrawals. But I tried to keep it narrowed.
Yeah. Yeah. Between the 1st and the 27th, he withdrew more than $1,500 in cash from ATMs across the area.
Still weird.
Still weird. That's not pocket change at all. And it wasn't all in one lump sum. It was scattered. So now this could have been because he was shopping for Christmas gifts. But when you look at it in the context of other witness statements, you have to wonder if he was moving money around in a way that wouldn't draw attention.
Yeah, because we'll get into them later, but like the witness statements, and maybe we need to ask Julie about this, about like what he gave them as Christmas gifts, but like,
yeah,
he gave Cooter Michelob.
Yeah, which is nothing. I mean,
yeah. So that's not something that would warrant like a $1,500 cash withdrawal. And it's over that, really, when you start looking at it. So it's almost like he's pulling this cash out. So he has it. And I know that some people like having cash on them, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I should probably be one of those people. I'm not.
Exactly what does that mean, Carrie?
I wish I had that because my kid is $2 me to death.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I'm like, well, buddy, I don't keep cash. But this is back in 2000. Cash would have been more likely. You don't have to deal with putting it on a card. You know what you're spending. I get it. That's still a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
But then there's this. On December 4th, Stephen paid $107 to National Car Rental, which, you know, at first glance seems maybe out of place because Stephen owned a red Blazer that he drove regularly. And within, I don't know, like a week or so of that, he purchased a blue Impala station wagon.
You know, working a case is like putting a puzzle together, and you try to get the, you know, you put the pieces together if they fit. Well, nothing's fitting here. Stephen had bought a Chevy Impala station wagon about 2.5 weeks before he went missing. And it was he bought it cheap. I don't remember what he paid for it, but it wasn't much. It wasn't a really good car. And nobody that I've talked to has seen him driving it. Every time anybody saw him, which he was well known and liked by everybody, he had no enemies. Yeah. But everybody that we talked to after he went missing, yeah, I saw Stephen driving his red Chevy Blazer, which was his main car that he drove. Right. And everybody saw him. Several people received Christmas presents days before Christmas. from Stephen. He showed up in his red blazer. Everybody saw him, even on the 27th. They saw him. One neighbor said, yeah, Stephen drove by in his red blazer. I waved to him. He waved to me. But when he went missing, the blazer was in his yard, and the Chevy Impala, which nobody had ever seen him drive, was what we found abandoned in the woods.
So why rent a car?
Yeah, that's a little odd.
It is, except maybe his blazer was older.
But
and the only reason I say that is because early on, Julie mentioned something that caught our attention. She believed her dad may have rented a car to take a trip to New Orleans around Thanksgiving. She recalled her father around that time telling her that things were bad and he was going to see Bill. Now, Stephen has a friend, Bill, and he also has a brother named Bill. Julie said the Bill that he was referring to was actually the old friend from high school. However, when Mitch spoke to Bill recently, Bill stated that he hadn't spoken to or seen Stephen for any significant period of time since high school, except for their high school reunion.
Well, throughout the investigation, and of course, speaking with Julie Pearson, Stephen's daughter, she had indicated that her father had always referenced a close friend of his named Bill, who was in a federal law enforcement agency. And Bill would, you know, was his best friend. He was always in contact with Bill. He was doing things for Bill and indicated that they were maintained a real close relationship, and that if he ever needed to disappear, that Bill would help him do that. He had also mentioned that to Cooter throughout the years, that he had a close friend that was a secret agent, and also told Cooter that he at one time was a secret agent, but he could not speak about it. And it just rolled off of Cooter as being one of his far-fetched tales that he was known to tell. But fast forward, Julie gave us the information on Bill, and I was able to locate him. He's retired now, but I was able to locate him. He lives in another state. And after a several hour interview and questioning Bill, he said, I went to high school with Stephen, graduated from McGill-Toulin in 1965. And Stephen was my best friend in high school. And then after we graduated, I went one direction, Stephen went the other direction, and we did not talk for 20 years until the 20-year reunion, high school reunion. He ran into Stephen, and of course, they reminisced and talked at the reunion and caught up on everything. And then the reunion was over, and several years went by. He never heard from Stephen again, didn't maintain contact with him. And several years later, Stephen was working at Ingalls, which builds military vessels. And there was a christening of a ship at Ingalls, of a military vessel. And the vice president was there doing the christening. And there was a picture taken of the vice president. And the picture was later published in a magazine called Navy Times. And in the picture, Bill was in the background of the picture. And when Stephen saw that picture, he got the magazine, put it in an envelope, and mailed it to Bill. So several years after the reunion, he had not heard from Stephen. He gets a package from Stephen, and all it had in it was this magazine that had a picture of him standing in the background of the christening of this Navy vessel.
Oh, wow.
But Bill maintains that after that, he never heard another word from Stephen until somewhere in 2020s, 21, 22, a mutual friend of theirs that also graduated high school with them, named Vonnie Hayes, he was a retired FBI agent. He called Bill and told him that Stephen had committed suicide.
Oh, interesting.
And
so Hayes told Bill this.
That's what the Bonnie Hayes had heard, and he related to Bill. And since then, Bonnie has passed away from medical issues, and so he was unable to be interviewed. This biggest issue with this is Julie maintained that her dad, Stephen, talked about Bill, even several times said he had to go to the airport and pick Bill up and take him somewhere and that sort of thing. But through the investigation and Stephen's phone records, there was no indication he ever called Bill or received a phone call from Bill.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
All very mysterious.
Very, it's very mysterious. I mean, was
it's
Stephen
kind of almost stuff of the movies, isn't it?
Yeah, it was, you know, the only thing I can say is maybe Stephen was a little delusional.
Yeah.
We couldn't find anything in the records to confirm that Stephen had taken a trip to New Orleans, but we did find evidence to support that he had taken a trip to Tennessee around Thanksgiving. I don't know where Bill lived.
I guess that's the question. Yeah. So it's possible the rental was tied to a trip, but his credit card isn't charged until December 4th, which seems a little late for a rental used on a trip around November 26th. And, you know, sometimes charges are delayed, you know, because they have to do, like, when you turn in the car, you do all, you know, you have to go through this process. But it does seem a little late for that, even.
It is, because while I was digging into this part of the timeline, something hit me. I had to rent a car last year because mine was in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and I looked at how the charges showed up in my bank account. The initial rental fee was processed the day after I picked up the car. Then the day after I returned it, there was a partial refund of about half that amount. Now I get it. This was over 20 years later. Different companies, different policies, but it made me think. Because when you look at Stephen's rental car charge on December 4th and everything else he was doing at the time, the gas stations, the ATM withdrawals, errands, they were all clustered around his usual area. Mobile, Grand Bay, Pascagoula.
So it doesn't appear as though he was out on a road trip at the time this charge was processed. But maybe that's just getting too far in the weeds now that so much time has passed. However, it does get stickier when you take into consideration that the last time anyone saw Stephen, he was driving his red Blazer.
Well, my immediate thought was like, wait, is this rental car for like a getaway?
Yeah, well, that was kind of me, you know? Too. Yeah. And you know, I get kind of backing up to when you were mentioning this. I was thinking, well, okay, so he has a red Blazer. Maybe something was wrong with his red Blazer. It wouldn't be so odd if, like, he was having car trouble and he then needed to rent a car. But then he also has the station wagon. So why did he get the station wagon and a rental?
And I was thinking at the time, like, well, he had both of them when he got the rental car, except for he didn't have, if I remember right, he didn't get the station wagon until December 11th.
Mm.
So this would have been shortly after the rental. Okay. So it's possible there were some issues with the blazer, except for
people saw him in it.
In the blazer.
Yeah.
And so my thought was like, getaway car, right?
Yeah.
And this will make sense to the listeners later.
Yeah. So make a note of that.
Yep.
And that wasn't the end of it. On December 24th, Christmas Eve, Stephen took out a $5,000 loan from City Financial. And his bank records, well, they tell a story. Stop after stop at a gas station, like he always was on the move.
And I didn't see anywhere in his bank records where that $5,000 loan was deposited, which makes me think that he got that in, like, cash.
Yeah, sounds like it.
So and the reason we know he got that is because there was a letter from City Financial saying, hey,
yeah,
we're happy you're our customer, whatever, here are your loan terms. So obviously he took that loan out. The money wasn't deposited into an account, at least an account that we know about. So did they write him a check for $5,000 and he cashed it?
And where did he cash it if he did?
I think he cashed it, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
There's a reason why I think that. So the morning of the 24th, he drove to Florida to visit his daughter, Julie, and his grandson. Julie told us that she had no idea he was coming. He showed up between 7 and 8 a.m., which meant he had to have left Grand Bay around 3 in the morning.
Phew.
That's early.
That's early. That's way early for me.
That's way early for me. I am not a morning person.
Yeah.
Jason got me up at between 6 and 6:30 on our trip to Pittsburgh to get on the plane to actually make it from Charlotte to Pittsburgh. And I told him that I felt like I was running from the wall. Because he was like, we got to go. And I was like, I'm not ready. I'm just not there.
It's like,
not there.
Get your bags. Come on. We got to go.
Julie said Stephen's behavior was off. Not aggressive, just wound tight. Manic almost. Not like the dad that she knew. Still, he brought their Christmas gifts, spent the day with them, and tried to be present. There's even a photo from that day. Stephen and his grandson smiling. And that's the last known photo of him. By 7:44 that night, Stephen was already on the road again. His bank records showed activity during the drive home, including that he made it to Lockfleet just before midnight.
You know what I'm noticing, actually, is kind of interesting, is he makes a lot of stops and charges.
Which, he does.
Like, even when I'm on a trip and I know I have to make stops, I don't make that many charges. I mean, I honestly, other than Amazon, I don't really make that many charges at all. So
about Amazon.
Yeah, we won't. That's I got a problem. Anyway. Somewhere in the middle of all that movement, between December 15th and December 27th, Stephen also helped a postal worker by delivering a package to his neighbors, as we mentioned. And if you go by James Bowman III, also known as Little Bowman, he says the package arrived on or before December 24th. But we'll circle back to that.
On or before December 25th, just a few days before Stephen disappeared, he stopped by his neighbor Cooter's house to drop off a Christmas gift. He invited Stephen to come in, but Stephen said he couldn't. He had other gifts to deliver.
And that might have been the end of it, if not for what came next. More recently, Cooter told Mobile County investigator Mitch McCrae that Stephen said something strange before walking out the door. Something that, at the time, felt like just another one of Stephen's tall tales. He looked at Cooter and Earlene, his wife, and said, "You won't ever see me again. I've got a plan to disappear, so no one will ever find me." You know, even for Stephen, that had to be odd.
Yeah, it's not what normal people do, of course. Mm-hmm. But through the investigation, there was several people that were interviewed, a Don Dixon and several other people that mm-hmm. Stephen had gone to and brought them Christmas presents and told them the same thing, that he was about to disappear and he had to go to a safe house. And wow. These people all didn't know what to think of that. Like they said, Stephen was liked to play jokes and tell funny stories and mess around. And right. They didn't take him serious at the time.
Now, Stephen was known to tell a story or two. Sometimes serious, sometimes not. So they just kind of laughed it off. But a few days later, when deputies showed up at Stephen's residence, that comment didn't feel like a joke anymore. As for Stephen's phone records, they show he was in regular contact with his friends and family during his vacation. On Christmas morning, the first call he made was to his brother Bill at 7:38 a.m. A few calls to friends in Biloxi, a short call to Julie, all of them happening before 8 a.m. None of the calls were long, 1 minute here, 3 minutes there, but they were all to people close to him, family, old friends, and likely wishing them a Merry Christmas.
That same afternoon, Stephen also stopped by another friend's house, Roland Roll Smitherman. He brought bread and candy, stayed for a short visit, nothing long. Just a friendly drop-in. And Stephen left in his red blazer. Roland later told police that everything seemed totally normal.
But by the next day, December 26th, things started shifting.
He made more calls. Bill Pearson again. Peggy Favre. His ex-wife, Nancy Pearson, John DeVoe, an unknown number in Past Christian, which may have been a female companion Stephen had at one time. All short, all local, with the exception of Nancy. Based on notes from Bill Pearson, Stephen left a strange message on Nancy's answering machine. Mitch spoke to Nancy recently.
I interviewed Nancy, and Nancy is his ex-wife, mm-hmm. and she maintained contact with Stephen. But during the time that he had gone missing, and the weeks prior to that, she was actually in Australia on a vacation or a business. I'm not sure which one. But when she got home, she had received a phone call, a voice. She had received a message from Stephen, and she didn't actually recall what the message said, but it didn't alarm her because, you know, she'd been in Australia. She comes back. She didn't even know Stephen was missing. And mm-hmm. she had this message from him. And then next thing she knows, she finds out that Stephen's been missing.
And the message on the machine was before he went missing?
Yes. Yes.
On December 26th, something strange happened at the Grand Bay Post Office. The local postmaster, Kathy Grimes, told investigators that two African-American women came in looking for a package they were expecting. One that should have been delivered to P. Carter at 11455 Wheatcroft Road North. After checking into it, Grimes discovered that the missing package hadn't been lost at all. It had been signed for by Stephen. She reached out, and later that day, he showed up at the post office to explain. Remember that package that Stephen delivered to his neighbors before Christmas?
I do, yes.
It turns out that James Bowman Jr.'s girlfriend, or wife, however you want to describe her, her name was Patricia Cartner.
Huh.
So, you could see how P. Carter and P. Cartner could be mixed up, especially considering since Patricia lived with the Bowmans.
Right, yeah.
And their address was also on Wheatcroft Road, except for it was on South.
Well, that would be so easy to mix up. I mean, this would be like a no-brainer. I would like totally do the same thing.
I mean, you can tell by how that would get mixed up. At first glance, you see like P. Carter on Wheatcroft.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's pretty close to Cartner.
Yeah.
So, you know, Stephen told the postal worker he would deliver it. And Stephen told Grimes that he delivered the package to the Bowmans. And that they had later told him that it contained marijuana. And we're going to get into that more in the next episode. But this information caught Kathy's attention. So she accompanied Stephen to the Bowman residence to clear things up. But when they got there, both James Bowman Jr. and Little Bowman denied everything. No package. No idea what she was talking about.
Grimes told Birch that Stephen seemed scared, visibly shaken. And during that visit, he started talking about leaving town. He didn't feel safe. Later that evening, he even came back to her office. This time, he told her flat out. He was going to a, quote, safe house.
That same night, December 26th, around 9 p.m., Stephen met with Don Dixon at Crispy Chick in Grand Bay. According to Dixon, Stephen handed him the bill of sale and the tag receipt for the Impala he'd bought earlier in the month. He asked him to get the car and the paperwork to his grandson.
One other thing that happened is prior to this, one or two days before he disappeared, the day before he disappeared, he went and met a friend named Don Dixon, met him at a restaurant, sat down, told him he was going to disappear, gave him the paperwork to the Chevy Impala, the title and the bill of sales, and said, give this to my grandson. Make sure he gets the Chevy Impala, the station wagon. So
is that kind of his way of explaining why he even got it in the first place?
His grandson was very young at the time. I mean, he wasn't driving age. His grandson, yeah. If I remember correctly, I think his grandson was like 7 or 8 years old.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But,
okay.
You know, Stephen didn't have much. And I guess he was wanting to give something to his grandson before he, you know, if he did disappear on his own, he wanted to leave something for his grandson.
Well, then Stephen said something odd, as if anything else so far has not been a little bit odd.
The whole thing is odd.
Yeah. He told Dixon he was having problems with his daughter, that he believed she was doing drugs, and that he was scared of her. That claim hasn't been confirmed, and it's worth noting he just spent Christmas Eve with her and his grandson.
According to Dixon, it wasn't the only message he tried to pass along before his disappearance. Dixon told Bert that Richard and Sue, whose last names are unknown, approached him on December 27th. And they said they'd seen Stephen and that he had asked them to let people know that he was, quote, gone. And to get his farm equipment and take it back to his house.
And then comes December 27th. That morning at 7:30, Stephen called the Mobile County Sheriff's Office to report a burglary at his home on Kingbird Road. He told the responding deputy that someone had broken into his bedroom window and stolen several Bud Lights.
That's interesting.
That's a little odd. While the deputy was there, Stephen found an empty can of Bud Light and his checkbook just lying in the driveway. The deputies tried to lift prints from the items, but came up with nothing.
Well, in between that time, Stephen's trailer was broken into. And really nothing of value was taken except for a couple of beers. And one of the beer cans was found out, the empty beer cans was found out in the yard. And also a checkbook. His checkbook was found out in the yard, which was odd. But yeah. Nothing else had been taken out of the trailer. So, of course, common sense would tell you it would be the two black females that were asking about the package, found out where Stephen lived, and went over there and broke into his trailer looking for the package, trying to retrieve their package.
Right.
But
so my question here is, well, I have many questions.
Okay.
But so knowing how Stephen is, that he's a little quirky.
Mm-hmm.
Did anybody suspect that maybe nobody actually broke into the camp trailer? That maybe it was just something he didn't remember doing or whatever. He had beer in his hand and his checkbook dropped. Was it could it have been coincidence, or was there like fingerprinting done when they went over to check on the break-in, or was it even reported?
Well,
I guess that's the kind
of question. He reported it to the sheriff's office and the deputies mm-hmm. came out and they actually fingerprinted the beer can and didn't find any prints on the beer can.
Okay.
Of course, there was indication of a burglary, and they wrote it up as a burglary. But there was no evidence to solve the burglary. There was no fingerprints anywhere that was lifted.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. That was one of the first things that I was thinking about when Carrie and I were talking about it. It's like, well, okay, so it sounds like that could be very plausible that somebody was, maybe they were looking for his address and that's why the checkbook, you know, not look for his address, but looking for other information about him. Or even, you know, maybe took a check to try to do something with the check. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, thinking, well, you know, knowing how quirky Stephen is, you know, maybe he thinks somebody broke in, but really it was not.
Then just 30 minutes later, Stephen was seen driving his red Blazer through Grand Bay. Larry Ferguson, a Grand Bay local, spotted him on Highway 188 near Henderson Camp Road, and the two of them waved at each other as they passed by.
Stephen was still active, still making calls. At 8:53 a.m., he called Julie. 2 minutes later, at 8:55, Stephen made a 6-minute call to Julie's mother-in-law, which prompted Julie's mother-in-law to call her. Julie said her mother-in-law was concerned because Stephen was saying crazy things and told her to make sure that Julie called Bill. Then, at 9:11 a.m., Stephen made a 2-minute call to Singing River Hospital in Pascagoula. The last incoming or outgoing call reflected on his cell phone record. All short calls, all back-to-back, and then nothing.
I can see how it would all lend to him being very paranoid.
Yes, he was obviously paranoid and somewhat, I guess you'd say, delusional, because he had talked to many people about his friend Bill, and that he would mention the word safe house and that he could disappear and never mm-hmm. be found again. That's not the conversation a normal person has. So he had some mental health issues.
Sure.
At some unknown time that day, a $62 withdrawal was made from Stephen's account at an ATM marked BT1. And to our understanding, that's Boomtown Casino. Hmm. And if it was Stephen who made that withdrawal, it might be the last transaction he ever made.
Well, that's interesting. So yeah. My brain goes to, okay, does he have a gambling problem?
Well, we'll get to that in the narrative.
The next day, December 28th at 9:47 a.m., Julie contacted the Mobile County Sheriff's Office to report her father missing.
The reporting party, Julie Pearson, stated that the last time anyone saw her father, Stephen Pearson, was on the morning of December 27, 2000. Stephen was the victim of a burglary at his residence on 11185 Kingbird Road. Deputy Law responded and was possibly the last person to see him. The burglary complaint number was S00121306. Julie received word from the office of Dr. Creighton, where Stephen is being treated for manic depression, that Stephen was especially delusional. They advised Julie to keep an eye on him. On the morning of December 28, 2000, Julie went to her father's house to check on him. She found that Stephen was not there. Concerned, she began driving the area looking for him. She found Sergeant Colvin on McClinton Road and reported the incident. Julie states that Stephen has mentioned to her that there are snipers in the trees around his home. He also told her that he may shoot her son. Dr. Creighton's office treats Stephen with lithium, which Julie claims he has not been taking. She also states he likes to consume alcoholic beverages and may be driving around in an intoxicated condition. Julie says Stephen is probably not a threat to others, but may be harmful to himself. Deputy Law stated that Stephen has a blue Chevrolet Impala station wagon, which was not on the scene while Julie was there this morning. Stephen mentioned that he likes to go to the casinos in Mississippi. The possibility exists that Stephen drove his Impala there. There where?
I know, that's what I was just going to ask.
So, according to the official narrative, Stephen Pearson was last seen the morning of December 27th. Making phone calls, driving through Grand Bay, stopping at an ATM, and then by the next day, he was gone.
A group called Alabama Cold Case Advocacy released this age progression photo showing what Stephen Pearson might look like today. And the group plans to put up a billboard in the Grand Bay area. Sheriff Birch says the department periodically revisits the case.
The bottom line is we never give up. And, you know, yes, it's been 25 years, but, you know, any relevant information, we will follow up on any and all tips. And we never, ever, ever give up on a cold case.
Next time, we'll walk through what happened after that missing person report was filed. Because not long after Stephen vanished, someone found his Impala. And when the deputies arrived, they didn't see a missing person. They saw a cover-up.
And the person who staged it? Still out there. If you have any information about Stephen Pearson's case, you can call or text 251-501-2653. We've set up Extension 3 as a dedicated tip line specifically for tips related to Stephen Pearson's disappearance. If you have questions or comments about anything you've heard in this episode, feel free to email us at info@alcoldcase.com. Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast, to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Red Circle to your favorite podcast platforms. Content, research, artwork, and production are by Sellers and Stormy of Alabama Cold Case Advocacy. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and research sources can be found in each episode's description. Your support helps us continue producing Unforgotten and further Alabama Cold Case's mission of advocacy and awareness. There are a few ways you can help us light the path. Make a one-time or monthly donation to Unforgotten through Red Circle, sign up for a one-time or recurring donation through the ACCA website, or subscribe to the Unforgotten Patreon channel for early access to ad-free episodes. You will find the links for all three in our episode descriptions. Another cost-free way to be of great help is to follow us on social media. But most importantly, whatever you do, tell everyone you know about these cases. Sharing their stories is one of the most effective ways to help find resolution for Alabama's cold cases. Be the spark. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
Good. You did good on that one.
Thanks.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.